Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Friday. It's September 23rd. From the ABC Weather, we've got Bob Bedore.
And welcome to fall. It is the official first day of fall. And I'm just here to give you great news. It's going to sound like a broken record as I go through your next 7 days here in Park City. But it's just going to be beautiful, beautiful weather. We're going to start off today, going to be sunny, high in the mid to upper 60s, which will be nice, clear tonight, dropping down to around 40 for your low. But then Saturday, we're just going to see sunny skies for a while, folks. But we're going to see high in now the low 70s as we're going to be gradually increasing in our temperature for the next few days. We're going to see overnight low Saturday around 43. Sunday, 73 should be about your high with a low in the mid-40s. 74 for your high on Monday, where it's just going to be clear skies and sunny. We're going to see drop down be about 46 for your Monday low. Continuing our highs, we're finally going to be into the mid-70s by the time we get to Tuesday under still mostly sunny skies. So this has been a great little pattern. The low is going to hit around 48. 75 is going to be where we're going to hit about Wednesday. Then finally, Thursday, we're going to start to see some clouds come into play through our state. This will be most of the state is going to be cloudless for a while. But then Thursday, we're going to see some clouds coming in. So there's a good chance, maybe even late Wednesday, where temperatures are going to be a very warm 79 through that night. But then Thursday, temperatures are going to start dropping down. We're going to be in the very low 70s. And we got a slight chance of some showers and thunderstorms, but it's going to be mainly still sunny on that day. Friday, another chance we get some storms coming in. So what you've got, folks, is you've got just a great start to your fall. Temperatures are going to be in the 70s through most of this upcoming week. It's going to be a beautiful weekend. And we got our outlook on when we can start to see the peak performance of the leaves changing. And that should be about mid-October. So you got a few weeks, but we'll start to see them gradually going. Again, by mid-October, things are going to be beautiful. But enjoy this weekend and enjoy this week coming up in Park City.
Okay, Bob, have a great weekend. Thanks.
You as well.
And on the phone with us, with our Mountain Trails report, we've got Park City Municipal Open Space and Trails Manager Heinrich Dieters filling in. Good morning, Heinrich.
Good morning, Leslie. Hey, you know, I think you just heard a fantastic weather report there, and, you know, the trail conditions couldn't be any better. So really encourage people to get out there. The leaves are starting to change. You know, you can see that in the maples and some of the trails out there, Lost Prospector area and Rossi Hill are great opportunities to get out there. But start with some trail closures. Our friends over at the basin have let us know that Collins down there in Sun Peak is closed for Rocky Mountain Power work. And then additionally, Rocky Mountain Power, if you haven't noticed, is working along the McLeod Creek Trail. So that pathway is actually open on the weekends, but it is closed during the week. So we ask people to pay attention to those signs. The crew, Tim and Rick, they have actually just finished some trails out in Clark Ranch. So it's about 3.5 miles. They're not officially open. It's on the east side of Highway 40. We don't have any signs out or parking area established or anything. But if you can find your way out there, there's a new 3.5 mile loop. It is an agricultural area, so we graze cows out there every so often. So, you know, the motto in the West is, you know, how you find a gate is how you leave a gate. So if it's closed, close it. If it's open, leave it open. So you can go out there and look for those and look for more information on that coming up in the next couple of weeks. Also, they are finishing up the Lynx Trail. So this is a trail on the west side of Park City Heights. I know that a lot of people in that neighborhood are going to be excited about that, but you can actually see Tim and the Mini-X kind of moving down the hillside there above Park City Heights. So maybe a couple more weeks or 2 weeks, and they'll be done with that one.
So where does that connect to? Where does that connect to? Or is it just
it's going to go down by the clubhouse, and it's part of an overall plan over there in Clark Ranch. At one point, when we finish the system over there, that'll be the climb, and then there'll be specific descents. But for right now, you are going to be able to find it if you're familiar with Park City Heights, like there by the clubhouse, the swimming pool, and it will climb all the way up towards Lost Prospector in the top of Skid Row. So that's where it's going to dump you off.
Okay.
So that'll be a cool one. There's a lot of good things happening over there. If you're a fan of Transit to Trails, which I hope you are, we did the last Thursday, Friday. I guess it's Friday, right? Mm-hmm. So this is the last Friday that it'll be running. So it won't be next Thursday and Friday. And then the last weekend transit trails runs is on the 15th and 16th of October. So, you know, hopefully you'll be able to see those fall colors, but we encourage everybody to do that. And then last thing, you know, if you're one of the probably 2,000 parents that bought e-bikes this year, you know, just remind people those can go pretty fast. And if your kids are going to be out riding those, you know, wear some helmets. That's just good safety. And if you're on the trails, it's cool to be kind. So wave, smile, and say hello.
Ring a bell. Ring a bell. They do have bells
ring
on them.
Ring a bell.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll fit that in somehow, Leslie.
All right, Heinrich. Hey, thanks.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Stay tuned. In just a few minutes here, we'll be checking in with Park City Municipal Environmental Sustainability Manager Luke Carton. He just got back from the Mountain Town 2030 conference in Breckenridge. Heber City Airport Manager Travis Biggs calling in. He'll have an update from last night's open house about some of the new airport master plan alternatives. And finally, parents Barry Nan Rothschild and Miriam Etchell are two who discussed their concern over the state legislature's recent law banning of by what are considered by some as sensitive materials and books from school curriculum. As we've reported, the Park City Board of Education is meeting this morning at 8:30 to discuss and perhaps approve that policy. No public input will be taken. Well, a contingency of Park City and Summit County officials returned from the Mountain Town 2030 conference held in Breckenridge, Colorado this week. One of those was Luke Carton, who serves as Park City Municipal's Environmental Sustainability Manager. Good morning, and thanks for joining us, Luke.
Thanks for having me.
So you were one of how many city staff members attending?
Two city staff members, two council members also attended, Max and Tana. Then Summit County also sent representatives. Community Foundation was there, and the chamber was there. And I apologize if I'm getting anyone else from the Summit County, Utah area.
Okay. Anybody from Wasatch County?
I don't think there were any attendees from Wasatch County thinking through it. There were about 400 people that kind of ebbed and flowed through it. So it was a robust amount of group. But I don't think there was anyone from Wasatch County. There were folks from Moab there, one person from the Salt Lake City area. So yeah, there was a good Utah representation. There were also folks there from Montana, Idaho, New Mexico, Colorado, of course, Arizona, kind of all up and down the Intermountain West. And then there were a couple of folks from random spots like Sunday River, Maine.
Yeah. This was something I believe that Park City initiated and held for the first time back in 2019 and then COVID.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So back in 2019, people might remember that Jane Goodall was in town and all this other stuff. And the goal behind it, Leslie, is just to say, hey, mountain communities, we're kind of facing the same issues. And the great thing is there's other communities out there that might be steps ahead of us to help solve these issues. I'll use an easy example, zero waste. There were at least four other communities at the Mountain Towns Conference that have curbside residential compost pickup, right? And it's a huge interest in this community. So the great thing for me is now I can go talk to them about what RFP did you run? What's the cost? You know, what are the pros and cons? And it's great. That's the goal, is just to kind of say, hey, you know, Jackson might be doing something, or Eagle or Breckenridge or Missoula, that we can learn from, and vice versa, right? We can learn from as well. You talk everything from electric buses to zero waste to utility. So it's a fun time, and it's also a diverse group, right? We had Skiri representatives, business representatives. Rosignol brought their, it's a really cool, like, fully recyclable ski. There was, you know, utilities, of course, towns, counties, larger cities as well. Denver was there. They did a great presentation. So it's just a really good learning exercise.
Sure. Did a lot of work, kind of our collaboration, happen in those 2 years that kind of COVID kept you apart?
Yeah, other than when COVID first hit, right? I think just like everyone, small towns were kind of thrown into the fray of, first of all, what's going to happen, right? We're going to have to lay off a lot of folks and then, you know, make the changes to get everything from hand sanitation to masks out and all this other stuff. But once we kind of started coming out of that, the collaboration's always there. The nice thing about the Mountain Towns piece is it's working right now to kind of simplify the solutions, right? So if you're looking at, again, to use the zero waste example, you can go through and see who's doing what, and then you can give them a call and follow up. Another easy example too is just outside Jackson, they have a EV car share program. We always get told it's not going to work up here and all this other stuff. Well, there's a peer community that's already doing it. So that's the goal, is just to learn from each other.
Yeah, we did try a car share program, and this may have been before your time.
Yeah, the U-Haul car share problem. And I don't know if they even exist anymore or what, but yeah, car. It, again, it's just it's a tricky thing because the volume that people use it or not and all these other things. But it was interesting to hear from another kind of peer resort community of the pros and cons of it and how they deal with everything. Because the crazy thing with EV cars, you're really trusting that the person before you knows how to plug it in. So it was interesting to hear about that. But we also had a keynote from Dr. Michael Mann. He is a world-renowned scientist. He was really known for the hockey stick graph, for all the climate nerds out there. We had presentations by a gentleman named Pete McBride, National Geographic photographer, does amazing work around water. He was actually the Basalt mayor like over a decade ago, and gave a really good kind of level set and perspective. For the Pete McBride event, the community of Breckenridge was invited in, just like when we invited in the folks for Jane Goodall. And it was great to see kids ask questions about water and all this other stuff. So it was a really impactful night.
Yeah. What was your biggest takeaway from the conference?
A couple of things. First of all, it always floors me how much we can learn from other mountain communities, or how often we repeat either failures or successes that other communities have, and we could have sped that up by making a phone call, right? So again, to use a zero waste example, there was a group called Vert Sites that handles zero wasted events and can run through it, and they would report back on metrics. There was a food rescue group that would take the conference food and get it into the community like within an hour. Those are simple steps that are pretty impactful. But it was also great to catch up with like the Missoula team that's looking at taking the Utah House Bill 411 stuff, the Community Renewable Energy Act, and actually run it up there as well. So again, it's just really great to share information with these other communities, because you know, anytime you travel somewhere else and you're like, wow, that's a really cool idea, we should do that here.
Yeah, so when we talk about Mountain Town 2030, what's the significance of 2030?
Yeah, the goal is just to get people acting, right? So a 2050 goal, I'm a government employee, I'll be 71 years old, so I'll be fly fishing and skiing and, you know, trying to stay out of trouble at that age. 2030 just kind of says, hey, we can kind of front load this and really start solving this, right? It's just always wonky to me of saying, hey, you know, 2050 goal, a lot of things can get back-ended. 2030 gives it that sense of immediacy. And I think even learning about like the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, it's a bill of over 1,000 pages. It's a snoozer to read, but there's some huge stuff in there. And our goal is to take a ton of that stuff that is now fully applicable to our community and drop it in. Everything from energy efficiency and renewable energy for affordable housing, government buildings, air source heat pumps in cold weather. There was a presentation by the Northwest Coalition of Governments in Colorado, Northwest COG, that talked about retrofitting affordable housing with efficient, called air source heat pumps. So that way it gave people heating and cooling and reduced their energy bills as well. So that was a really awesome takeaway of, hey, that's a practitioner doing this that we can then follow up with and understand everything from the model to how did they find the contractors to do it and all this other stuff.
Yeah. Did you have any like updates with regard, because there was a study that I know that KPCW was part of and Park City Mountain years ago, you know, that basically just showed at, you know, at this year, the snow level is going to be here, you know, and 5 years later, the snow level is going to be another 1,000 feet up the mountain. I mean, are there any updates to that study?
Yeah, there's a few, and I can provide kind of sometimes getting them localized. It's kind of like zooming down, and it's, you know, it's people sometimes are skeptical or not. But I think the other thing too is talking to communities and also utility that had wildfire impact their communities. This Kit Carson Electric Co-op, which is in northern New Mexico, they serve tribal lands, four ski resorts, and all this other stuff. They had part of their grid shut down for 3 months. And you talk about just, you know, outside of not having power, but people who are on home care and stuff like that. So that was a really good trigger of saying, hey, you know, you have the incremental slip of snow going up the mountain, but you also have these catastrophic events. You know, there were people there from South Lake Tahoe that talked about the Caldor Fire. And again, it was just one of these things you listen to, and it really kind of wakens you up of being like, you know, yes, the loss of snow. We've lost 6 weeks of winter since the 1970s. But then you also think of, like, you have that kind of steady drip, and then you also have the large wildfires, the floods. You know, talking to Moab about their flooding that just happened a few weeks ago, too. It's a good way to kind of do that resolve and not just look at the studies, but actually understand the current impacts in these communities.
Sure. So what about a EV car share in Park City?
Yeah, it's truthfully, it's on the list. I think the biggest priorities for me coming out of it was learning about the zero waste piece. You know, the community is, you could say, either speaking loud and clearly or screaming for that kind of concept of food waste is kind of the next big lever we can go after. You know, when you look at residential waste, it's I can double check the waste characterization study, but I'd say it's like in the 30 to 40% range. Our commercial side, it's even higher. And it's an area that we should truthfully look at, right? We have a landfill up here that's filling up, and it's something that there are solutions for. So I think that'll be a really impactful piece. Like I said, the Inflation Reduction Act, we're sorting through that, and the federal government's still sorting through timing, but I'm reminded of an old New York senator, Alphonse D'Amato, that said, you know, the federal government serves up the pie. Our job is to get the biggest slice of it. So we're going to be looking at ways to get the word out around all the benefits that are out there for folks, that if you're looking at, you know, changing out your heating, or if you want to do, you know, if there's solar or there's EV stuff, there's a ton of stuff in there. It's just, there's a lot of stuff that we're just trying to unpack and understand. All right, these are the areas that we can kind of help. And is there ways that we can talk to contractors and give them a heads up too? So I think those are some major pieces that we're looking at. The EV car share piece is actually a really interesting one. So they're actually going to share some information around that with us. So that was really cool. And one last one is talking to folks from the Teton County area, Jackson area, about how do we engage the ranching community. You know, the ranchers have been here for generations. They know how to manage their land and stuff like that. They want to do the right thing. So how can we engage them in this too? And I think that was a really good conversation of understanding how we can kind of continue to bridge that gap instead of being the crazy little resort town in the middle of a ranching piece. It's like those folks understand the watersheds and all this other stuff. How can we tap into that community and help align and you know, find that mutual beneficial steps?
Yeah, so back to kind of the zero waste part of this. I mean, what are we talking about? Are we talking about getting one of those incinerators where you would just collect it, burn it, and create compost?
Hopefully we wouldn't burn it. So there's a couple options. So you've got something called aerobic, which is just like the piles that steam, and this is actually what Breckenridge and Summit County, Colorado do. So they make piles, they add some wood chips in, and then you get the bag of compost out the tail end. Something called anaerobic digestion, which is the other side of it, which is think of it as like a gut that, you know, the microbes in there eat it, and then they actually produce renewable natural gas off it. So we're actually looking at the cost benefit analysis of both. I think a lot more to come on that, but we're looking at both. How do you structure a contract for residential and commercial? And again, there's a good amount of communities we can follow in their footsteps. And then what's the end product?
Right. We just signed a contract, I think, didn't we, with Republic in terms of, I mean, is there something in there that would require this? Or
yeah, so a couple things. HPCA is going to go zero waste, and we have a consultant working with HPCA and ourselves to get us there. On the community-wide one, the Republic contract allows for residential composting to be an add-on to the contract.
Okay. So the final day was spent on how community and business leaders can prioritize climate change. And I guess, I mean, what is it that community members can do?
Yeah, I think truthfully be involved and also help bring your knowledge to this, right? We had a presentation by the town of Eagle that went through a pretty horrific accident. They lost two city council members and a prominent local kind of activist in an avalanche. So they went through this tragedy, and they paused and they kind of said, hey, let's really dive into sustainability to honor those folks. And they had some huge impacts, but it was interesting to hear them talk about it. And the mayor of Eagle talked about how he's been a public servant for 15 years, and how the sustainability stuff, he goes, people are engaged, people are coming to the table. There's a developer that came in and is doing a 200 unit housing structure that's fully electric. So it was like cool to start hearing those things. And again, how to tap into the collective brain of our community to really drive these things forward.
Okay. Anything else you think people should know about?
I think just stay in touch. There's a lot of innovative things going out there, and just reach out with your thoughts.
All right. Did another resort town step up to host next year?
We're figuring it out.
Okay. All right. Hey, Lou, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Lou Carton is Park City Municipal's Environmental Sustainability Manager. Well, more than 60, community members are rallying around the Park City High School girls' tennis coach accused of child abuse, that after allegedly defending herself from a student's attack. KPCW's Carolyn Murray spoke with a team member's parent about the incident and has this report.
Faith Peterson is the mother of a senior who has played tennis on the Park City High School girls tennis team for 4 years. Peterson told KPCW she attended an event on Tuesday, which drew about 60 people who she said showed up to stand in solidarity with Coach Lanny Wilcox and help raise money for her legal defense. As of this report, a GoFundMe effort has raised over $16,000. Peterson said Wilcox, charged with child abuse of one of the team members, has been a part of the Park City's tennis community for a long time.
Lonnie is an important part of the tennis community, whether it be club players to the high school tennis girls tennis team. The girls love her, have the utmost respect to her. None of those girls would ever even think about hitting a coach. That meeting was about unity, about showing Lonnie that we're here to support her. We have raised a lot of money on a GoFundMe for legal fees because people see the injustice.
Peterson said a 16-year-old team member attacked Wilcox because she was unhappy with her coaching decisions. According to Peterson, the student also attacked the assistant coach, Brad Smith, kicking him in the groin as he tried to intervene. Peterson said her daughter and others witnessed the event.
And she absolutely clocked Lonnie. And there were other coaches that I know that were at the mark when this happened. And they were like, in my 20 years of teaching kids, I have never, ever seen that kind of assault on a coach. Just incredibly out of control.
The Summit County Attorney's Office charged Wilcox with one count of child abuse, a third-degree felony. The student allegedly slapped Wilcox in the face during an argument over the student's position on the team. After that, Wilcox reportedly grabbed the student by the neck, put her in a chokehold, and then took her cell phone. Taking the cell phone is a separate misdemeanor charge. Utah law prohibits taking communication devices when someone is calling for emergency services. Peterson told KPCW that her daughter said that while Wilcox was trying to restrain the student, the coach fell to the ground and sustained a concussion. She said the people who know Wilcox and saw the event are stunned by the child abuse charges filed against her.
A criminal, like, child abuse charges? Are you kidding me? Like, it's just insane. It's really insane.
Peterson said the high school and Park City police interviewed her daughter during school hours this week. According to Peterson, some parents are concerned about the incident and the potential safety of their students.
The girl was the instigator. Lonnie was trying to grab her hands to calm her down, fearing for other kids, another hit to the face for herself. But none of this has been addressed. But I think that it's a societal thing. But sooner or later, we're not going to have coaches. We're not going to have teachers. We're not going to have anybody that wants to deal with these entitled children.
Due to the ongoing investigation, the Summit County Attorney's Office cannot comment on the case. If anyone witnessed the incident firsthand and wants to submit a statement, they should contact the Summit County Sheriff's Office. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
And a reminder that the Park City Board of Education is meeting in a special session right now as we speak at the school district offices on Kearns Boulevard. The one agenda item is to review and possibly approve updates made to policy 9051, which deals with sensitive materials that are prohibited in the school setting. The school board earlier this week, as we reported, heard from a standing room only audience of concerned parents and teachers asking the board not to ban books, but rather let parents concerned with sensitive reading materials to opt their children out of reading a book they may find offensive. There will be no public comment taken. Again, the meeting starting right now. Well, Heber City officials hosted a public open house last night to discuss the airport. On the phone with a recap, I have Travis Big. He serves as the airport manager. Good morning, Travis.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. The open house showed the public some of the ideas on the table and explained the methodology of the multi-year study that is underway. Start by explaining to anyone who may be unfamiliar with what's happening. What triggered this study, and why are upgrades to the airport necessary?
So basically, we're a public use, federally funded airport. And because of that, we agree to contracts that are called grant assurances. So anytime you take federal funds as an airport, you sign these contracts called grant assurances. And the grant assurances basically say, okay, you're part of this national system of airports. We want them to all be uniform. We want pilots to feel safe as they fly in. They'll know that your safety standards are the same as all the other airports that they go to. And so we've accepted these grants over the years multiple times. The airport was built in the 40s. The government gave it over to us and said, we're going to let you manage this public use airport. as long as you follow our agreements. And our agreements are that you're going to leave it open to the public. You're not going to discriminate to which aircraft can use the runway, and that sort of thing. So they, as a federally funded airport, they've asked us to, their job is to keep it safe. And so as we've got an increase in the speed of the traffic comes in, the jets come in a lot faster than, you know, some of the older aircraft we had, the Cessnas and the multi-engines. And so their concern is that, you know, if a Cessna is coming in to land at your airport at 30 miles an hour and they slide off the runway, they might go off, you know, 50 feet, 100 feet. But if a jet comes down to land and they slide off the runway, they could go hundreds of feet. And so where our airport is located is right next to 189. And so the concern is that it's just too close. So they want us to increase the buffer zone between that runway and everything else.
Right. So it's the FAA that is basically requiring these improvements to be made then?
Yes, because they fund us. Mm-hmm. Their job is to maintain safety, and so they have standards and data, and they keep track of that sort of thing. So they're just saying, if you want to continue to be a public use airport, you need to follow the same safety standards as everyone else. And because of the speed of the aircraft coming into your airport, we need you to have a bigger buffer zone between that runway and the highway and that runway and the hangars and different buildings at the airport.
So how much money are we talking about? I mean, that the FAA is providing to support this airport.
So since the 90s, since we started taking federal funds since the 90s, I believe it's around $20 million is what we've received in grants. Most of that goes to pavement. So it's either we extended the runway, we extended the apron. Every 4 years, we have to reseal and do crack seal and maintain those pavements. So every 4 years, like last time, we just to reseal the runway and the taxiway and some of the apron, last time was about $600,000. And I imagine that's going to be significantly increased with inflation and all the increase in costs that have been going on. I imagine that'll be quite a bit more. So that's every 4 to 5 years. And then there's just a lot of other operational costs, snow removal, gates, fences, the AWOS tower we have that records all the weather to report to the pilots. There's just a lot of costs.
Yeah, so I hear that the FAA is actually paying about 90% of operations. Is that accurate?
Correct. So we get between the FAA and UDOT Aeronautics, they pay for about 95% of the capital improvement projects and major projects like that. We have to come up at the airport with another 5%. Luckily, we're one of only about 3% of the airports in the United States are self-sufficient like we are, where you can with federal funding, you can still manage to pay for all your operational costs and your improvements without getting into the general funds of your local taxpayers.
All right. So the airport was built in the 40s and then turned over to Heber City not until the 1990s?
No, it was handed over before that. It was built in the 40s, and then I don't remember the date when it handed over, but it was 40s or 50s, I think. They did that across the nation. So they built a lot of airports because of the war. Once the war was over, instead of trying to manage all these airports everywhere, they found it easier to just say, hey, you have to leave it open as an airport and it has to be, you know, safe and all these other things. But you can have a little more say with your locals to help. You can kind of help direct what direction you want it to go in, and you have some say in it. But you can't just do whatever you want, but you can help manage it. You can make plans. You can submit your, like this whole master plan process, we're going to come up with the best alternative that we would like to see, and we'll come up with an airport layout plan that we'd like to work towards, and then we submit that to the FAA, and as long as it's reasonable, then they'll accept it or approve it.
Okay. Well, I guess you had mentioned that it was since the 1990s you've received about $20 million in grants. Were you receiving funds from the FAA then between the time that the city accepted the airport and the 1990s?
I would have to go ask my engineers. I don't know that there was a lot. It was a much smaller airport, and it didn't require a lot. It was a much shorter runway. So I guess the short answer is I'd have to look into that.
Okay. And so you say we're doing this because we've got faster planes. And some who sound like they're on board with the need for the safety upgrades, at the same time are concerned that once you do that, now it attracts even larger planes than and you're just going to have to continually upgrade the facilities. So then you're just back to the same old thing as we are right now. So at what point, you know, does that stop? Because so planes are always going to get faster, right?
Right, faster. Their concern is, the biggest concern, it seems like, after speaking to a lot of people last night, it really comes down to noise. They don't like the noise. And most people equate a bigger aircraft with a louder noise, which is definitely not always the case. There's these old little jets from the 70s that are four times louder than some of these bigger corporate jets that are newer. But regardless, it's more the noise and the growth. I mean, it's just like everything else. The people don't like the growth. They don't like that everything's just growing. And so the airport, obviously, as the community grows, the airport grows. As to your question about the concern of it just getting bigger and bigger jets, the FAA, all this stuff is on our website, by the way, HebrewValleyFlightPath.com. But the FAA's written us letters. They've said, look, we are not asking you to allow bigger planes. At the meeting last night, there was a girl that had made a comment. She thought that there weren't any of these Globals or Gulfstreams coming in and that they would come in if we did this. I don't think that's true. We already have Gulfstreams and Globals that come in. And the FAA has told us specifically multiple times that we're not obligated to allow for bigger, faster airplanes. They're saying we want the same planes that you have today. We just need them to be safe. If we wanted you to allow bigger, faster planes, we would be requiring you to increase the weight limit of your runway, and we'd ask you to increase the length of the runway. I don't believe that we're considering either of those. We don't want to lengthen the runway. In fact, we pushed really hard to see if we could shorten the runway. But we're not allowing for bigger, faster aircraft.
Okay. And I guess, but aircraft can get lighter, faster. All of those things and still bigger. I mean, I guess, do we need to start looking at other regulations rather than just the speed of an airplane? Should we look at noise? Should we look at weight? Should we look at, you know, other ways to cap, to make sure that the airport is serving the community that, you know, is helping to pay for it?
Yes. And one of my favorite quotes. So I deal a lot with the city council, obviously, and the mayor and the city manager, and we're always looking for all these things. All of them would love to not do anything, and they'd love that if jets quit coming in and all that. That's not practical. It's not reasonable. But when Mike Johnson, I hope he doesn't mind me quoting him, but when he was running, I loved how he put it. He said something to this effect. He said, I would vote to keep the airport safe for everyone involved and for the minimum improvement required by contractual obligation with the FAA. Nobody wants the airport to expand, neither do I. Nobody wants larger jets, more noise, more air pollution, neither do I. And that's a very common sentiment. None of us want that. We're just trying to find what's the most logical, legal, practical solution that we can maintain this airport as small town feel, cater to our smaller piston aircraft. We don't want to encourage more jets from coming in. We can't necessarily stop them, but there are things that we can do that will, we could do things that would encourage more traffic, and there's things that we could do that will kind of help not allow for that.
Yeah. So I guess our council member Johnson's sentiments then part of the mission statement, the vision here is that that everybody knows that this is the plan.
Yes.
Okay.
So the misconception seems to be sometimes is that, you know, certain city council members or city leaders are just, you know, pro growth for the airport, and they don't care and they want to grow it. And that's not what I'm hearing from them. What I'm hearing from them is like, what do we have to legally do? What's the minimum legal thing that we have to do and without causing an increase in traffic? And like I say, again, the FAA has said over and over again, we are not asking you to allow for bigger, faster aircraft. We're simply saying the aircraft that's already using it need to be more safe. And so we're asking you to shift the runway away from everything else, which is, by the way, going to increase our, whatever you want to call it, green space, open space, the non-buildable space That's another interesting thing. You hear a lot about airport expansion. There are some properties that would need to be acquired or hopefully acquired to provide for a safety area around your runway and taxiway. You have like an object-free zone. So there's like two farms down at the end of the runway, and if they shifted it, it would be very helpful to have some of that land, because then that's where the taxi lane would go.
Yeah.
But if they didn't want to sell it or it didn't work out, you can still make it work. You just have to, you wouldn't have a taxi lane on that area, and you'd have to back taxi and some other things that would just complicate things. But
yeah, you mentioned
things that look at.
Yeah, you mentioned the word, you know, acquire that property. You could also condemn it, though, yeah?
So my understanding is because the properties that they're looking at for safety areas, now this is not buildable areas. This is just safety areas that they just would rather not have people in, or, you know, it's just to protect people on the ground, basically. Those areas are in the town of Daniel. And so my understanding is we can't eminent domain people in another city. And I don't think city council or anybody that I've heard of has any interest in eminent domain. But even if they did, I don't think that they could.
All right. Again, where it sounds like there were, while the presentation presented several options, really only one was portrayed as feasible, and engineers answering questions, basically saying that that's what they would eventually recommend to the city council, that would basically move the runway. Any other noteworthy changes?
Besides the moving of the runway?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty significant. So when you hear about airport expansion, that's tricky because, yes, if they could get the land at the end of the runway to protect that, that would technically, you know, change the footprint a little bit. But if you look at the actual airport, when I think about expansion, for example, I have 300 people that want to build hangars right now. Well, we're holding everything off until we figure out where we're putting things and all that stuff. Well, with this safety increase, most of the apron would have to be replaced somewhere else. And so that new apron would take up space that otherwise would be for hangars. And we're looking at putting another, if we wanted to increase the jet traffic or make more money at the airport, we would put in another jet FBO and turn it into kind of a jet center, and we'd encourage it and we'd push it. We don't want that. We want to let our FBO that takes good care of the jets already anyway, and have, you know, we have pretty significant costs for landing fees and that sort of thing. So there's things that some pilots don't come here because they don't like the cost. And so if we wanted to increase that, we'd bring in another giant jet FBO and put in competition and lower prices and all that. We don't want that. We want them to continue to take care of the ones they're already taken care of, but we want maybe another FBO that caters more to our local guys and keeps the small aircraft taken care of. And then you use up all your buildable space, and at that point it's kind of built out. So that, in a sense, that's a way of preventing exponential growth.
Yeah.
Now, it's more difficult with transient aircraft because people that want to just fly here, that's a little trickier. But with your based aircraft, you have a little more control.
Okay, I'm about out of time, but last question here. I mean, it's some communities aren't on board and never will be on board with this. My guess is that the project will move forward with, you know, the recommendations. So when's the soonest construction could begin?
So I think Jeremy at TOR Engineers addressed that a little bit. He said something about, you know, maybe 8 years if it was moving fast. Every step you take, especially with the federal government, they take their time and they make sure they do it right. You have to do environmental studies that take a year or two. You have to figure out where you're going to put the hangars. You got to build new hangars before you tear down the old hangars. You have to connect those. You need to move you build the new apron before the old apron. So getting the runway would be down the road. It's years down the road. I have to tell the FAA 5 years ahead of time if I need capital improvement funds or if I need new snow removal equipment or anything. I have to tell them 5 years ahead of time before that even gets on the idea plate for them. So it takes a long time.
Okay, well, we have a long time then to keep talking about it. Hey, Travis, thanks for your time this morning.
You're very welcome. Have a good day.
Travis Biggs is the airport manager of the Heber City Airport. Well, a Park City School Board meeting on Tuesday brought out a large crowd with about a half dozen people weighing in on the school district's decision to not adopt Policy 9051, a new sensitive materials policy. In the studio to tell us why they are opposed to it, I have parents Mary Ann Rothschild and Miriam Etchell. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
So my understanding is that policy 9051 was dictated by a bill that was passed this year by the legislature, House Bill 374, basically requiring school districts to allow parents to challenge curriculum selected by teachers based on interpretations of sensitive or inappropriate material. So we'll hear from both of you. Barry Ann, maybe you start. I mean, what in your mind is wrong with this policy? Isn't it a good thing to get parental input?
Well, we already have mechanisms for parental input, and they're pretty robust. So I am completely confused why anybody thinks we need more than that. We all get disclosures, for instance, from teachers in the upper grades with a list of reading material that they're going to be covering. And you always have the option as a parent to ask for a different source text to teach the material. And it's been like that as long as I've been in the school district. There's already a novels adoption committee in the school district, of which I've been a member previously. And there are educators on that committee, there are parents on that committee, there are administrators on the committee. And we have really such an amazing population of teachers in this district who are highly trained and really know the materials that will best suit their needs and their students' needs.
Yeah, I just got to follow up on that. I mean, but how does that work in the classroom? I mean, if you're talking about book A and a student or two are, you know, reading book B, how do you even have that discussion in a classroom?
Well, I think, again, we have highly skilled teachers who understand how to draw the nuances into the conversation about the overreaching theme that they're trying to teach. So it's really not necessarily about getting into the nitty-gritty of a particular passage in a particular book as much as it is, although that does happen, as much as it is about making sure that the lesson is taught that they're trying to get at.
And Miriam, what are your issues with Policy 9051?
I want to echo what Barry Ann said. The teachers are well trained. They know what's age appropriate. I personally, you know, read books to my kids before they were ready because I don't. I couldn't teach two texts at the same time and get to the same place because I'm not a teacher. But these are highly trained people. They're trained to do this. And my kids, we always knew what books they were reading. We always had the chance to say we don't want them to read that book. You know, I told a story at the meeting about when my son was at Jeremy and he brought a book home that I had never heard of that I found mortifying. And I didn't complain to the administration. We talked about it at the dinner table for a week and a half probably. And, you know, I trust the kids of Park City to be able to read complicated ideas that they don't agree with. And I trust the teachers to teach.
Yeah. So in that case, then, you didn't agree with the book being taught.
Right.
So did your child then read the book?
Yes, absolutely. And I didn't object. I mean, you know, at Jeremy, that administration is just great. You know, the principal's great. I knew I could talk about it if I wanted to, but I didn't. I felt like it was okay for me to say to my kid, this is what I disagree with, and for my kid to say, you know, I don't think you're right, even in fourth grade.
Yeah. So the book was read. You had the discussion.
Yes.
And that it was handled that way.
Yes.
Oh. And if you had objected, how would that have been handled?
My understanding, and I'm not, you know, I'm not an expert at this, but my understanding is that I could have gone to the teacher and the teacher would have said, in fact, in this case, this was a book my kid chose out of five different books. So I could have absolutely said, I don't want my kid to read this book.
Hmm. So I think the book in question is Sherman Alexie's book, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, right? And it has been banned in other school districts. It's also been restricted to kind of extracurricular book clubs. I mean, the concern that I've read, it's alcohol, bullying, violence, sexual references, profanity, and slurs. I mean, should this be required reading for ninth graders?
You know, those are things that are happening around our ninth graders every day. Every hour of every day. It's stuff that happens in our school district all the time. And I think having literature that helps our kids explore how those things are harmful, how those things can be managed, how things that are people who are different from them should be included and learned from, I think that's critical. I think you have to have literature that gives. It's separate enough from the children's experience that they can examine it and then bring it back to their own world. and apply those lessons. You can't necessarily read a book about somebody just like you and understand the contrast.
Yeah.
Well, and I would say also, I mean, my kids and one of Barry Nan's kids were in the class where two eighth graders died from drugs. And so to say that we don't want our kids to read material that's sensitive, they're living it.
Yeah. It's the school board on Tuesday then voted to send the book back to the curriculum committee to address the constitutionality of the policy. I mean, any idea what needs to change in that? I mean, what's unconstitutional about as it was written?
Well, there are very likely some First Amendment issues in that policy. And, you know, I spoke at the meeting about how the First Amendment is my thing. You know, I have a background as a journalist. I have a degree in English and American literature. The freedom of expression is a core American value. And that's something that the more we curtail it for our children, the less they're living it.
Yeah, anything that you wanted to add to that, Miriam? I mean, just in terms of the constitutionality aspects of this?
Well, I think that, you know, as Barry Nan said, we have a robust mechanism for parents objecting to books, and I don't think we need to add any more to that. If you don't want your child to read the book, they don't have to read the book. If you want to object to the book as a whole, you already have an option to take it to this committee. And my understanding is then to take it to the superintendent and then to the school board. So you have some appeals as well.
So have you heard about what changes? I mean, are either of you on that curriculum committee? Do you know what changes, if any, have been made?
I don't know.
I'm not.
Okay, because the school board is meeting as we speak take that down. I mean, it also sounds like the Board of Education between a rock and a hard space here. I mean, they approve the policy or risk losing funding?
That was my understanding, and I think part of why they went into closed session was to explore what their options are legally and in the state and try to figure out how they can manage this, because it was clear that, you know, they had some pretty vocal constituents there who were not happy about it.
Yeah. Are there cases of pornography in the literature being read by children that you're aware of?
So one of the teachers at the meeting spoke very movingly about that issue, and she said these are books that, you know, are considered literary, have been approved by, you know, various committees in various places, and that, you know, she said repeatedly, we are not teaching pornography. And what I was struck by with the two teachers who spoke is how much they're being attacked, how emotional they were, because they are not feeling, you know, my sense is, and I don't speak for the teachers, I'm not a teacher, but that they were feeling very much like they were not supported by their community. And, you know, I was just saying to Barry Nan, you know, I feel like these teachers, in many cases, love our kids and really want the best for our kids and are working so hard. And it seems pretty thankless at this moment.
And I have to echo that. I not only was so moved by what I heard from the teachers at the school board meeting, but I went to back to school night for my 10th grader, and I came home just kind of floating, and I said, I guess it's frowned upon for parents to enroll, but these people are so inspiring, and they're so committed, and they're so dedicated, I kind of want to go to their classes. And what was really heartbreaking for me was when I started getting text messages from teacher friends who were listening on the YouTube channel and thanking me profusely for standing up for them. And I thought, well, I didn't do anything other than speak the truth and support people I already support. I don't understand why you're so thankful. And they said, not everybody feels the way you do, and it's really hard.
So I guess, what are you hoping for? I mean, based on the you know, the input that you did give.
I'm worried about the funding also. So I guess what I'm hopeful for is that we can support the teachers and that we can come up as a community with a way to also support the parents who don't want their children to read books, which again, they don't have to read any specific books if they don't want to. But I'm hopeful as a community that we can come together and be supportive of our educators who work so hard.
Yeah, Barry Nan?
Yeah, I would echo what Miriam said, and I think we have such bright minds in our education system here that I'm confident that we can come up with a solution that will keep us in compliance with a superfluous piece of legislation.
Yeah. So it sounds like the parents are really pushing back here in terms of there's apparently some kind of investigation going on into, you know, what teachers are teaching in the classroom. Are you aware of any?
I've only just become aware of it. Again, I'm really pro-teacher, and I'm really happy with the education that my first child received and my second child is in the process of receiving. They've come out of this district and come up in this district as critical thinkers. I couldn't ask for more than that.
Yeah.
And I get more than that.
Yeah. Have either of you or both of you read the book in question here?
I have not.
I have.
Yeah.
I have. It's a wonderful book. It's a smartly, emotionally moving piece of literature, and it's meaningful.
Yeah. At one point, I think it was one of the One Book, One Community choices,
yeah.
Wasn't it?
It yes. was, and Sherman Alexie came and spoke here. And, you know, those opportunities are golden. I didn't have opportunities like that in my childhood. I don't know a lot of people who did. We're a unique community where we get that kind of access to authors and artists and all sorts of people who can influence and inspire our children.
All right. Well, Baron Ann and Miriam, thanks so much for your input.